Welcome. Welcome to another episode of Fired Up. This is your man, Steve. I'm your host here as we get into what's underneath the hood in politics today. First and foremost, I want to give a shout out to WJMS for hosting this podcast every week. So to Ms. Jams, the CEO, we appreciate your faith and confidence in us. Also, we got a power-packed show today. We got a lot of stuff to unpack and cover. But I do want to get a couple of housekeeping items out. You can now reach out to your man here at Fired Up through email. Our email address is firedupradio@yahoo.com. And our Facebook page is in its final stages. That will be coming out probably by the time our next episode airs. So we'll have an announcement out of that. And we also are up on Twitter at @RUFiredUp. So you can search us out on all of those platforms, and we'll be putting information up there. There'll be information on the WJMS homepage as well. So we're moving. We're getting out there. So where are we at? Well, it's been an interesting month so far. We've had some more clown car activities coming out of Washington. We've got the impeachment hearings going on, full bore. We've got the Republicans, storming the castle, trying to roll in 40 deep into a hearing where they're already represented. What's up with that? It's a bipartisan hearing, and yet, an additional 40 Republican senators decided they wanted to be in there. And they just stormed the room. And not only that, this was a secure facility, and they went in with their camera phones operating, which is a violation of the rules, And the key question is, why did they need to be there? There was no point to it, So the administration continues to play these games, to throw this distraction our way, to try and divert us from the real facts at hand as the investigations go forward. The Democrats are obsessed and are focused like lasers on the process of this impeachment process for the president, and we'll see how this plays out. The impeachment will likely come down through the House. It's questionable as right now as to whether or not the Republicans are going to vote to impeach and remove the president from office, but we'll see what transpires, and we'll keep you posted as to what happens. Because over the next couple of weeks, the public testimony in the impeachment hearings will be conducted. We will follow that and summarize and bring you what the important points and information are that come out of that. In addition, there are a lot of other interesting items that have surfaced over the past, few weeks, notably an accusation of obstruction by the Republicans of the president's agenda and items that he wants to move forward. And it begs the question, I seem to recall that certain individuals in the Senate pledged after the previous administration was sworn into office for their first term that they were going to, number one, do everything in their power to make President Obama a one-term president, and two, to obstruct, block, and not do anything on his agenda that he brought forward to the House and the Senate. So it'll be interesting to see how that little bit of hypocrisy plays out. Just as a reminder, my general working principle is that I don't discuss individual politicians or people unless they are directly related to the subject at hand. But of course, when we're talking about impeaching the President of the United States, that means we are going to have to talk a little bit, about, Mr. Trump, and we're going to have to talk a little bit about the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker of the House and so forth as they work their way through this process. So, as best we can, I want to stick to the mechanics of what's going on. And part of that is, and we will talk about this in a few minutes, as to what exactly impeachment is, because there's some confusion out there where, you know, people are confusing the action of impeaching an elected official with indicting and prosecuting a civilian criminal. And there are some distinct differences. So we're going to talk about that. Another subject that's been discussed in the media sources lately is this question of, are we, that is the United States, heading into what is called a constitutional crisis? So we're going to get into some of the background information on what exactly that is and what it means and how that impacts and plays into what's going on in our political system in the U.S. today. It's a lot of information. We're going to dive into it deeply. So, you know, as I always say, strap in, keep your hands and feet inside the ride at all times, and we will jump in and get started right now. So let's start by opening up this topic of impeachment. As a definition, impeachment in the United States is the process by which a legislature, usually the form of the lower house or the House of Representatives, brings charges against a civil officer or government for crimes alleged to have been committed, analogous to bringing an indictment, as I mentioned, by a grand jury. At the federal level, this process is directed by the House of Representatives. They set the rules as to, you know, what and how the impeachment process will occur, and, you know, set the guidelines for interviewing and deposing witnesses, set the guidelines for what the articles of impeachment will be, that is, what specific items the individual, in this case the President of the United States, is being charged with. You know, this is in a similar fashion to a criminal indictment. However, this is not a process by which the individual actually would be, you know, arrested and brought before a judge and charged with a crime and so forth. Under impeachment rules, the House of Representatives prepares the bill of particulars, the charges that are being levied against, as I said, in this case, the President of the United States, for what items or violations have occurred. There is a unique definition of this, as it's stated in the Constitution, and it calls that impeachment can occur for certain specific crimes of an individual while in office, such as bribery, treason, and other what are called high crimes and misdemeanors. That's the extent of what the Constitution calls for as chargeable offenses under an impeachment. The founders left it specifically vague so that the work needs to be done to define what the offending items are and why, and the case needs to be built and presented to back up those charges. Once the House of Representatives has determined, you know, what the impeachment is going to be for, what the specific items or charges are going to be, and how, under the rules, they are going to address the impeachment, you know, it will be, you know, prosecuted in the House of Representatives. They will call the witnesses. And as we have seen over the past few weeks, this process started with a series of depositions given behind closed doors, away from the public, where witnesses were called in either by demand of the House or by a subpoena, if necessary, for those that were reluctant or resistant to coming in of their own free will. And they are questioned by a representative body, bipartisan, so that means Democrats and Republicans are participating in this deposition. Both sides get to ask questions, and the rules, as again set up by the House, determine what the time limits are, you know, and so forth for that questioning. And, you know, that information is analyzed and documented, and a report is created that is handed to the Judicial Committee of the House of Representatives with a recommendation either of pursuing an impeachment charge, you know, or not, depending upon, you know, what the evidence has shown. So, you know, as we go through the public hearing phase, which, you know, as of the recording of this, or as of the airing of this show, actually, is likely still ongoing, we still do not have a fully defined picture of what specific charges are going to be leveled against the President of the United States. In the process, once these charges are, you know, conferred, then the articles of impeachment or the impeachment process will move to the Senate, where the actual trial will happen. And because this is in regard to the President of the United States, the presiding officer of the trial will be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And, you know, this will follow somewhat a more trial-like process. There will be, you know, witnesses, there will be cross-examination, there will be discussion, and ultimately there will be a vote as to whether the president is to be impeached and removed from office, or if some lesser charges will be conferred. In our American history, this will be the fourth time that a sitting president of the United States has been brought up on impeachment charges. No president has ever been removed from office because of being impeached, although Richard Nixon came the closest, and he ended up resigning just prior to the announcement of his impeachment trial in the Senate, when it became clear that he did not have the support of his party going into that. More recently, President Bill Clinton was brought forward on impeachment and obstruction charges, and was ultimately not convicted on either of the two counts that were brought against him. One count was for perjury, for lying under deposition, and the other was for obstruction in trying to obstruct the process. He was not convicted of either of those two charges because the Senate was not able to achieve the two-thirds majority needed to basically convict on impeachment. And as I said, Richard Nixon resigned before the Senate process was begun. So even though he was accused and brought up on impeachment charges by the House, those charges were never tried in the Senate, as Nixon resigned from office and was subsequently pardoned by his successor, President Gerald Ford. So, you know, impeachment, you know, is not a punishment of an individual. The founders intended impeachment to be a way to correct an imbalance in constitutional government by, you know, one element of government, in this case the executive, abusing power or doing something else that you know, went against the oath of office, the Constitution, and the laws of the United States. So as I said at the top of the section, this is not a criminal process, although if an elected official did commit, you know, a more serious crime while in office, impeachment could be applied to remove that individual from office, and then, you know, prosecution under our justice system could move forward and address the criminality of the act. Impeachment really is a remedial tool put in place by the founders to maintain the co-equal balance of our government system under the Constitution. So it's as we go forward with, you know, this impeachment process, we go forward not knowing what the outcome could be. You know, could it be that, you know, the president gets impeached and removed from office? We don't know. Could it be that, like Nixon, when he sees the handwriting on the wall, the president would resign and remove himself from office, thus removing himself from the impeachment process? We don't know. So we will have to, you know, wait until the process plays out to see what the vote is. Is there going to be a two-thirds majority in the Senate to impeach and remove the president, just as it has to be a two-thirds majority in the House of Representatives to push forward the articles of impeachment? These are rules that were set in place in the Constitution by our founders because of the serious nature of the need to remove an unfit officer from their duly elected office. So time will tell, and it will be interesting to see how this process plays out. We're going to explore some other elements of this, some things where, you know, people are saying that this process is causing, you know, a so-called constitutional crisis. And we're going to talk about that too, you know, in the segment coming up. It's important for us to pay attention to what's going on, not to be distracted by all of the sideshow things going on, you know, the personalities of people, you know, being questioned in the committees. And it absolutely would be, you know, necessary for us to pay close attention to the public hearings and make sure that we fully understand, you know, what's being asked and what's being explained. As I've said, it may be easy to get your information fed to you, you know, a teaspoon or a tablespoon at a time, you know, through social media, through mainstream media, through all of these elements. Really, you need to dig in, do your diligence, and, you know, look for unfiltered sources, one of which might be C-SPAN, which will no doubt cover the public impeachment hearings from gavel to gavel every day. It's what they did during Nixon. It's what they did during Clinton. And that would be the best way for you to get the real information and draw your own conclusions, which is the first step of taking action and moving forward so that you understand and are not just accepting what various media sources, including myself, to be, you know, 100% transparent, are presenting you. You know, gather your own facts, do your own research, you know, find out what the truth is for you, and then come to your own conclusion. That's the key to, you know, understanding how government works. So you can't really have a conversation about a crisis with the Constitution without understanding what the Constitution is. It is four parchment pages, handwritten, more than 232 years ago. And there's no way that the Founding Fathers could have foreseen the things that have transpired in our country since 1787. But yet they put this document together to give us guidance, to give us a blueprint, a roadmap for how how our democracy could be run. So if you think about it, the Constitution sits at the top of a pyramid, and flowing down from that are all of the laws and interpretations and precedents and opinions and everything that has been generated since its writing and its ratification 2.5 years later by the states of the United States at the time. And it's an amazing document. However, when, you know, actions of, you know, individuals or parties or some other element defines an area for which the Constitution and the subsequent laws and precedents that have come down from it over the course of time can't handle, that falls into what is generally called a constitutional crisis. A more formal definition, constitutional crisis is a political conflict in the function of government that, you know, the Constitution or other fundamental governing law is perceived to be unable to resolve. So, you know, generally it is something that has occurred for which, A, there is no precedent in law, either, you know, legislated law or law that has been handed down from a court or ultimately from the Supreme Court, it is, in one sense, it is a crisis that arises out of the failure or a strong risk of failure of the Constitution to perform its central functions. It could be, you know, the government wants to pass a law contrary to its Constitution. If the government wanted to pass a law that says, you know, the third-born child of every U.S. citizen will be gathered up and shipped off, you know, for imprisonment or to some type of camp. Well, obviously, that's going to violate several rights granted under the Constitution, and that could cause a constitutional crisis. You know, again, I'm not a lawyer. That's a hypothetical. But you get a sense of what we're talking about. It is something that the existing laws just don't have a handle on, don't have a way to resolve, or a path to find a resolution. When that occurs, then, you know, we are breaking very new ground. And basically, we are writing, you know, an additional chapter to our governing documents. You know, constitutional crisis can arise when two branches of government conflict. It could be in the case that we're seeing the potential of a so-called constitutional crisis, you know, is the role that the Department of Justice has been playing, you know, in the processes that have gone forward since the 2016 election. Some might argue that, you know, these processes and these interference and this failure to act and other elements form the basis of a constitutional crisis because it places the one branch of government in conflict with the wishes and goals set forth by another branch of government. So, you know, a constitutional crisis can be many things. So when you hear about, you know, news sources or, you know, anchors or individuals, you know, talking about or writing about and presenting things that could be a constitutional crisis, understand that they may be describing things for which our Constitution just has no methodology to handle. Again, this document was written 230 years ago. There was no internet then. There weren't cell phones. There weren't, you know, any of the things that we have, you know, commonplace today. So, you know, it's up to our courts and ultimately our Supreme Court to interpret laws and interpret actions and find a way to address them given the information that is out there with regard to our Constitution and all of the documents and discussions and laws and precedents that have come from that. You know, one of the things, in addition, you'll also hear referenced from time to time is something known as the Federalist Papers. As the Constitution was being circulated or being presented to the states for ratification between 1787 and 1791, when it was finally ratified, the founders, the people who sat in committee and wrote the Constitution, wrote many articles to newspapers around the country, which was the primary way of communicating. And there are a total of about 85 what are called Federalist Papers, where different elements of how the Constitution is intended to work, how it was designed, kind of what the thinking was going into specific elements. These papers are often referenced even today to give insight into the thinking of the founders in putting together our Constitution of the United States of America. I would suggest, as part of your due diligence, is, you know, go online, download a copy of the Constitution, set up a link to the Federalist Papers, and there are several out there, so that you can go in and search out these elements and get answers to questions you may have. You don't necessarily need to print them all out, even though most of them are short, as they were, you know, the equivalent of today's op-eds in, you know, the newspaper of your choice. But, you know, you should be able to have a ready reference when you have a question. So that kind of sets out, you know, a constitutional crisis. And, you know, looking at those two things, impeachment process and, you know, what exactly a constitutional crisis is, gives you insight into what the real deal is or should be going on with our government as we process through this current iteration of political drama going on in Washington. You know, we need to make sure that, you know, we are getting our information from a pure source, that we are not letting, you know, anybody, whether they're on the right, on the left, in the middle, or whatever, you know, guiding our thinking. We need to do our own critical thinking, something, you know, I've said before in our call to action, you know, do your diligence, get your answers, make up your mind, right? So those are just a couple of things. We will talk more about these. We will talk more about what's happening in Washington as the weeks progress. You know, again, I really just want to focus on the mechanics and the nuts and bolts of what's going on, not so much about who said what to whom, when, who knew what, when, and so forth. You can make your own decisions based on the information you hear and the research you do with regard to that. So that being said, we will now, you know, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll get into our call to action segment. Got a couple of things in this week's homework assignment for you. So, you know, we will be right back. Thank you for listening. And, you know, I appreciate you tuning in to Fire It Up right here on WJMS. Amen.
Voice from the throne, seen the 24 elders and I knew I was home. I was told to write a song for the people. Take the original Hebrews on an exodus of black excellence. Tell them to invest in us and make testaments about each other on how we sisters and brothers cover the land and corners with poems of stone. Go hard with it, let them know you God with it. Even though I offered it, let no one margin it and make it all about paper or first week sales. Though this is from heaven, give them verses from hell. Those that fell off the path, bring them back to the map. Your staff will be your microphone. Your name is Common, you was born to fight the norm. Take house niggas out of darkness till they lights is on. I'ma put a hyphen on your name, rapper, actor, activist. You the one that can reach into the black abyss. Stars this asterisk, show them what a classic is. Freedom riders need passengers. In your lyrics, use scriptures and passages to make them rise like Lazarus and resurrect it again. They'll put disrespect on your name and respect it again. Every section you in, bless them and keep bussing. If they don't like it, shake the dust and say fuck them until you get home. I'm the one you trust in.
I'm happy to be in any place where God's name is remembered.
Speak with diligence and authority. The fake out of Pharisees and Sadducees. Give them that God, be free from the black odyssey. Yo, pardon me, you the God bodily, functioning on earth as a part of me. That's why I gave you artistry. Going to the hoods with the shooters and the strippers. Forget the newer order, new Jerusalem is with us. Tell sisters, they earths and goddesses. If they got bottom, don't get caught in a bottomless pit. There's a lot of us fit for the kingdom is near. You can tell by the wars and how the seasons appear. You'll appear in circles in Hollywood. I birthed you in Chicago, you know how to poly good. You'll get Oscars, Emmys, and Grammys. Give those to your family, don't get caught up in the vanity or the world's insanity.
Trouble on this world. Trouble. They mean, in English, peace be unto you.
Welcome back to Fired Up with your man Steve here. We're talking about the political machine, and we're going to move right into one of the other subjects that deals with how our government is created, and it's called the Electoral College. In the process of electing our president, there's a popular vote which is conducted every 4 years in November. We have another one coming up this coming November 2020, which is going to be a real barn burner. But the popular vote, just so you're aware, is not entirely the way that the president is elected. There is an item called the Electoral College, which was established in the Constitution by our founders as the method for actually selecting who it is who becomes president. Each state is allocated a number of electors equal to the number of senators that they have and the number of congresspeople they have at the federal level. So, for example, if your state has 13 districts, then your state has a total of 15 electoral votes, one each for each of the two senators that you have mandated by the Constitution, and one additional one for each of the representatives in the House. Now, most of the states work on a winner-take-all strategy. Not all of them do, but most of them do. 48 out of 50 actually work that way. Two states have a system where the electors are allocated by the percentage of votes that each party wins. So what happens with those electors is that once the election has concluded, the Electoral College gathers together in January, and the vote is tallied, and the final count of the number of electors for each candidate is what actually determines who becomes the president, the incoming president of the United States. The Electoral College is a constitutionally mandated process that determines who serves as president and vice president every 4 years. Electoral votes are each based on, as I said, the popular vote, although popular vote does not directly decide that outcome. It is based on the number of congressional House seats you have and two state senators each per state. So this compromise was included in the Constitution in Article 2, Section 1, if you want to check it out. Each state is required to appoint those electors equal to their members of Congress. So as the initial count was set up, the Electoral College was designed as a method to balance out the state votes and kind of mitigate those states with the highest populations from having an outsized impact on the election to president for the United States. At the time of the founding, states like New York and Virginia were the most populous, and therefore, if you just went by a straight popular vote count, those two states would probably just have decided most of the presidential races probably for the first 80 or 90 years of our nation. This Electoral College is actually a very unique construct among the world because it is the only one where it is not the popular vote of the people that actually decides the leadership. And as we found in the last election in 2016, the person who received the most popular votes actually lost the presidential election because the other candidate actually accumulated more Electoral College votes. As I said, 48 of the 50 states and the District of Columbia, which has three votes, by the way, even though it is not a state, 48 of the 50 states in the District of Columbia allocate all of their electoral votes to the winners of the popular votes. Maine and Nebraska are the only two states that allow for this division of states among the percentage of popular votes in each party that the candidates accrued. In the 21st century, there have been some debates on whether or not the Electoral College has outlived its usefulness and that the United States should go to a strict popular vote method of deciding its president. Some people argue that it reflects truly the will of the people. Supporters of electoral reform argue that the Electoral College does not reflect the will of the American voters, however. Reformers also suggest that changing demographics create a gulf between the voice of voters and the Electoral College math. Abolition or or substantial reform of the electoral vote process would in fact require a constitutional amendment, which would have to be ratified by 38 states in order to become law of the land. So this is something that continually comes up for discussion, and something that one day in the future may actually come to pass. The electoral process has not been without its controversy. In 1800, President Thomas Jefferson was elected after the House had 36 ballot votes because there was a deadlock in the Electoral College process, and the Constitution calls for each state delegate in the House to be issued one vote and to cast that vote for the winning candidate. And of course, many of us still remember the 2000 election between Clinton Vice President Al Gore and Governor George W. Bush, which came down to an absolute tie of the Electoral College vote, with only Florida remaining unresolved on Election Day, or Election Eve, or the day after Election Eve, actually. What ended up happening was they had to do a recount, and that gave us the infamous Hanging Chad. And for those of you who remember, there were images of, you know, voter registrars checking ballot cards and trying to determine what actually a hanging chad was. And it ended up going to the Supreme Court, where the decision was brought down that George W. Bush won the election and got Florida's votes, thereby becoming president of the United States. So the electoral process, you know, is complicated. Our founders really tried hard to make sure to keep conflict and other concerns away from the process by which we elect a president. And for 230 years, they've had, you know, pretty much good success. So that's kind of how that process works. We're going to change topics, change direction a little bit here, because I want to talk a little bit about the state level elections. As you know, I'm a big proponent of keeping your eye focused on the state level elections, that is governors, state houses, state senates, your local elections, your city councils, your town boards, your sheriffs, your school boards, etc. So in the United States, believe it or not, there are 224 political parties that are ballot qualified to participate in the presidential elections in the country. Democrats and Republicans are represented in all 50 states, so giving them a total of 102 out of that 224. Among the parties that are there, that are nationally recognized, the Libertarian Party is recognized in 37 states, the Green Party is recognized in 26, and the Constitution Party is recognized in 14. Many other parties exist, some of them some very, very specific focused parties. For example, there's a party in Colorado, the American Constitution Party. Michigan has a Natural Law Party and a U.S. Taxpayers Party of Michigan. Minnesota has a grassroots legalized cannabis party that is registered and recognized in that state to participate in the presidential elections. And the list goes on and on and on. So there are parties out there for every political consideration that's out there. There's a party called the Justice Party in Mississippi. There are constitution parties in many states. I think, as I mentioned, I think they're in 14 as a total. Looking at the list, and some of the Party for Socialism and Liberation in Florida. So, whatever your political cup of tea is, there's likely a party out there that supports it. Florida also has an ecology party. So, you know, there are a lot of avenues for us to be involved in votes. And remember, you know, it isn't necessarily, you know, the parties that you vote for. Yes, it's important that you have a party affiliation and that you vote with that party, but it's equally important that that party reflect your thinking and how you believe our government should run. Now, that may mean that your party is not among the majorities, but that should still not stop you from, you know, exercising your right to vote, because those down ballot races are extremely important. Let me give you a picture of some of what happened in the election that we just concluded on the 5th of November of this year. And what we had was a total of 10 states where seats were up for grabs in the state House of Representatives and or the state Senate. For example, you know, in Mississippi, in the House of Representatives, before the election, the Republicans were in majority control. After the election, that didn't change, although the vote counts toward that race did shift in slightly in favor of the Democratic Party, but not enough to have them turn over the House. Same thing with the Senate. It remained a Republican Senate after the election as it was before. In New Jersey, the Democratic Party maintained control of the New Jersey General Assembly after the November 5th election. Now, the big one and the newsmaker that occurred was what happened in the state of Virginia. In Virginia, the House of Delegates, which is the House of Representatives in that state, actually changed hands from Republican to Democrat on November 5th, as did the Virginia State Senate. So both houses of Virginia legislature now or in January will be democratically controlled, whereas prior, or you know, they were Republican controlled. In the state executive election results, that is election for governors, lieutenant governors, attorneys general, and secretary of states, Kentucky, as of the count just after the 5th of November, was still up for grabs. We'll check our news sources and get back to you in an upcoming show as to what happened there. So it wasn't sure whether the Republicans retained control of the governorship, at least as of the time of recording of this. In Kentucky also, the attorney general seat went from being a democratically held seat to being a Republican held seat. In Kentucky, the secretary of state went from being Democrat to Republican. In Mississippi, the Republicans retained control of their secretary of state position. In Mississippi also, the Democrats were also ousted as attorney general in that state. So as you can see, the state level and local level elections have tremendous importance in what happens in your state. What I suggest is that you go to a website called ballotpedia.com and check out what your state did. They have results on all of the elections that are held. And it's an easy and fast way for you to find out what transpired in your state. The next piece, there are a couple of things to also be aware of. There were many, many ballot initiatives, that is, questions that are posed to the electorate for decision by the state governments. For example, let me get my list, and I'll give you just a few highlights. In Colorado, there was a Proposition DD to legalize sports betting with tax revenue going to fund water projects measures. Kansas voted to eliminate the revision of census population amendment, and that would have changed how the counting of certain minority groups in Kansas would be counted. In New Jersey, a question on property tax deductions for veterans extended to continuing care retirement communities. That was approved. So they are going to maintain the tax deduction there. Texas, one here that's a key one. There was a ballot question that would allow, you know, if affirmed, for municipal judges to serve in multiple jurisdictions. That was defeated. The voters did not want that to happen. There was another proposition to increase distributions to school funds, a proposition to institute bonds for cancer prevention and research was approved. In Washington state, a non-binding question on e-cigarette and vapor product tax was approved. You know, vaping and e-cigarettes have been in the news lately due to health issues. So that was a hot button subject. Another advisory vote in Washington, and this one was a non-binding question on limiting sales tax exemptions for non-residents. That was approved. So as you see, just by this little sample, there are a lot of things that happen at the state level that are decided at the time of these national level elections or in these interim elections that occur throughout the years between, you know, presidential cycles and off-year, two-year cycles that occur. So it goes back to saying why it is so critically important for you to maintain contact with what's going on in your state, keep abreast of the ballot questions that are there. I do recommend that you use websites like ballotpedia.com where they have this information in, you know, in ready supply for you to check out. One last piece of information before we close out this segment and get to our call to action. You know, a lot of questions get asked about exactly how big are the parties in the country. And again, there's another, you know, graphic that's available online, and I will post this to the webpage, and I'll give you more information about that in a few minutes. But it breaks down the Republican and Democrat and independent registered voters for the United States of America by state and as a total. So as a total, this reports that there are 110,943,417 registered voters in the country, of which 44,242,975 are Democrat, 32,570,817 are Republican, and 31,489,028 are listed as independent. And that breaks down to percentages where the Democrats have a 40% majority in the country, followed by Republicans at 29% and independents at 28%. In previous episodes, I've talked about the role of voter suppression activities to limit the amount of voters of one party or the other to participate in the election. Now you can see the reasoning why. If, you know, for example, if the Republicans can suppress the Democratic vote, you know, below that 29% threshold, then they, in conjunction with, you know, conservative independent voters, would have enough percentage of votes to swing the election to the Republican Party. Conversely, if the Democrats can show out to the polls in significant numbers and maintain their numerical lead, they are generally going to win in a national election. Now, as you look at the state list going back and forth, in many states, those percentages are somewhat similar, with a few notable exceptions. You know, for example, in Wyoming, 18% of the voters in Wyoming are registered as Democrats, 67% are registered as Republicans, and 14% are independent. In Maryland, 55% Democrat, 26% Republican, 18% independent. In New Jersey, 40% of the registered voters are independent, 22% Republican, 37% Democrat. And in, you know, my former home state of Massachusetts, 54% of the registered voters are registered as independents, with 34% Democrat and 11% Republican. So although it varies, you know, state by state, the overall percentages are 40, 29, and 28 for Democrat, Republican, and independent nationwide. So it gives you an idea, and again, as we've talked about in prior episodes, it gives you the idea of exactly how the strategies can play out so that your vote can be affected or effectively nullified depending on what types of strategies are used. So just some interesting information and why I stress and say that we must, if we are going to be fired up, if we are going to be ready to go, if we are going to be taking woke to the next level, and which is to be in action and actually doing what we need to do in order to bring our country back to the kind of democracy that we want, whether it's Democratic, whether it's Republican, whether it's anything, but one that is representative of its people, then these is the kind of information that you've got to be on top of. You need to be doing your diligence, as I say, you need to be doing your homework, and you need to be engaged in the process. Reaching out and talking to your local elected officials, your state elected officials, and your federal elected officials. So that's our segment for this week. Coming up next, we're going to get into our call to action segment. And again, I want to thank you for listening. My name is Steve. The name of the show is Fired Up, because just being woke is only the beginning.
Winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting, 'cause nobody knows what to say. Save your soul. Constitution, a noble piece of paper, with free society, a struggle, but they died in vain. And now democracy is a ragtime on the corner, hoping for some rain. It looks like either hoping for some rain. And I see the robins perched in barren treetops. They're watching last-ditch races marching across the floor. But just like the peace sign that vanished in our dreams, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. It's a winter. It's winter in America. And all of the hillers have been killed or betrayed. Yeah, but the people know it's winter. Lord knows it's winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting, 'cause nobody knows what to say. Save your soul from winter in America.
And we're back. Welcome back to Fired Up. This is your host, Steve, and this is our segment where we do what we call our call to action. And this week, our call to action is focused on the power we have at the local level. So if you followed the November 5th election this year, you'll notice that we learned a few very valuable lessons out of that election as we look forward to the upcoming 2020 big, big ticket items that are coming in our political system. In Virginia, Virginia turned its entire government from one party to the next in a contentious race, but nonetheless, the Democrats now control all three legs of the government in the state of Virginia. Same thing in Mississippi and Kentucky, however, just on the Republican side. But again, you Republicans, you showed out, you got your vote out there, and you retained control of your state. Kentucky, you put yourself in with a new governor, switching parties by the same token. And definitely you were not happy with the governor you had. And even though the vote was tight in the end, Kentucky now has a brand new governor of a different party. So we learned from that when we are passionate about what we believe in, when we want to make sure that we are keeping our legislators and our elected officials, you know, responsive to us, we do that by getting out to the poll. So our first call to action for this week is to continue that, to keep informed, to keep learning what are the issues out there that affect you in your state, as well as in the national level. But again, as I've said many times, politics is the art of the local game. So you have to see what's going on in your area. What are your elected officials doing about it? What's their position? Communicate with them. get out, get in front of them, contact them, and make sure that they are doing what you elected them to go to that office and do. So learn more of your local issues, then get out and vote. That's our first call to action for this week. Our second one really isn't new. It's a reprise of one we have, and it's going to be a recurring theme over and over as we go through this year. Make sure that you are prepared to vote. Is your voter registration current? Do you have all the correct documentation and proof you need so that on election day there is nothing standing between you and casting that ballot? What does that mean? That means making sure, number one, that your ID is up to date and current with your current address. Second, find out what you need when you show up at the polls to vote. If the ID is all that you need, make sure you have it with you. If you need to bring some backup documentation, some jurisdictions may require you to bring things like a utility bill, a phone bill, you know, something that reflects the address that you live at. Make sure you have that information with you. If you don't know what it is that you need to have or where you need to go vote, recommend that you go to www.vote.org. That's VOTE.org. Look up under your state and your district and see what are the requirements. Where is my polling place? What do I need to bring with me? Make sure you have that information in hand and start now to make sure that it is all current and up to date. Don't wait until the last minute. Don't wait until the day before election day to try and get all of this in place. Make sure that you are fully prepared to get into the polling place and get done what you need to get done. And our third call to action is simply this. Get connected to Fired Up. Get connected to this program. We're going to be giving you a whole lot of information, a whole lot of assistance, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, your questions. You can email the Fired Up Show at Fired Up Radio. That's all one word, all lowercase. That's firedupradio@yahoo.com. And you can follow us on Twitter @RUFiredUp. That's A-R-E, the letter U, Fired Up. And that's our handle on Twitter. If you've got comments about the show, you've got questions, I'd love to hear them. If you have suggestions for future shows, absolutely want to get that too. If you've got feedback, tell me what you think of the show. Do you like it? Do you hate it? You know, I will be happy to engage any and all questions or comments that come out. I gratefully acknowledge and appreciate it. The bottom line is, you've got to get in charge. You've got to take control of your political future, starting with your vote and the votes of those around you. Please, 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 if you are not registered, get out and get registered. If you don't know the issues and the actions that are happening in your area, learn it up. Do your diligence. Do your homework. Find out what's happening in your community and vote to make the change you want to see. That'll do it. That will do it. So that's everything for this week. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. I do appreciate everybody tuning in and listening to the show. Again, get me your feedback. Get me your comments. I'd love to hear from you. Until then, and until next week, we will see you then. Have a great week. Be safe. And remember, fired up, because being woke is only the first step. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.